This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about the legacy of 9/11. One question that emerged quickly after the attacks was about skyscrapers and what would make these soaring structures safer. How could more people escape in case of an emergency? It was a problem that dogged architects, city planners, developers, and office workers. The collapse of the World Trade Center towers and the way in which so many people became trapped with no way out pointed to important changes that should be made. Where are we with those changes? 20 years later, Chad Slaman went to find out.
There's this one enduring photo from the North Tower of the World Trade Center that symbolizes the heroism of first responders. It's a tight shot of a firefighter climbing up the stairs. He's in full gear, sweat covers his face, and he's actually looking right at the camera. When Glenn Corbett looks at this photo, he's looking past the firefighter, focusing on the people all around him, trying to get out.
You'll notice that the people going down, the people evacuating are stopped, and in some cases they're sideways because the limitations and the width of 44 inches.
The stairs, they're only 44 inches wide.
This became a major bone of contention after 9/11.
Glenn is an associate professor of fire engineering at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He was one of the advisors to the federal team that looked into the 9/11 attacks from an engineering and fire safety perspective.
That day of 9/11, you had two stairwells, 44, 156, to serve literally over 10,000 people in both buildings.
That number, 44 inches, it's not arbitrary, but it is outdated. Glenn says it comes from all the way back to World War I. The average shoulder width of a soldier was 22 inches then, so the code doubles that to 44. Wide enough for one person to go down while another goes up, only...
When you walk, you don't walk like straight down. If you actually take a film of someone walking and slow it down, you see that the top of their body moves side to side, so it's actually wider than that.
There's all kinds of worrying little surprises about the code. Like, you might think high-rise buildings are designed with total evacuation in mind. Get everyone out, right? They're not.
You know, we don't. We do not design for full building evacuation.
They're designed at most to evacuate the three largest floors at once. It's a bit counterintuitive at first, but as buildings get taller, pointing straight up into the sky, engineering a quick way to evacuate the whole building becomes something close to impossible.
Because here's the problem. Remember we said about stairway width. If we increase the stairway width to accommodate more and more people and stuff, you'll find out that, of course, the building becomes all staircases and no occupied floors, right? It's all staircases just because of the number of people.
And Glenn says even if the towers had that extra stairwell, it still wouldn't have been enough if the planes had struck later in the day when more people were at work.
Many several thousand people probably would have died in the collapse only because they literally were trapped in the stairwells at the snail's pace trying to make their way out of the building, basically.
It takes a while to climb down dozens of flights of stairs. It takes longer, of course, to climb up, which hindered the work of first responders.
Both of these fires are at least 80 floors above ground level. So just simply getting up there was a Herculean task. We know that, for example, Battalion Chief Oriel Palmer certainly got to the area of impact in the South Tower literally a minute or two before it collapsed.
South Tower.
There's a documentary about this. It's terrifying.
478. Got a fire over here. Two more civilians. We gotta get two engines up here. All right, 10-4, we're on our way.
With horrific stories like that, Glenn thought something like wider staircases would be an easy addition to the code, become an obvious must-have in any new skyscrapers.
I mean, what we thought were no-brainers, right? We thought would be sort of a simple upgrade that we really felt was needed, ended up being a real fight for a lot of this stuff.
The GSA, Government Services Administration, pushed back hard against the recommendations. So one federal agency wanted wider stairs, another didn't. In the end, the code mainly changed only for buildings above 420 feet, so roughly 30 stories and higher.
When you get above that, you're in a different class of building.
You need to have more stairs, and they need to be wider. The code also allows these buildings to use specially designed fire-safe elevators as evacuation tools. Glenn says it's a step in the right direction, but not nearly enough. So far, only a handful of new buildings in the U.S. have these new fire elevators. I could only find two that work automatically for evacuations. And this 420-foot cutoff, Glenn calls it a magic number, thinks the stricter requirements should apply to shorter buildings than that. The main obstacle is money. Safety is an investment that may never show a return.
We're fighting dollars and cents. It's all about money, right? It's about literally trading off extra stairway width, you know, for less rentable office space or usable office space.
The conventional thinking now in high-rise regulation focuses on ways to keep the building standing as long as possible. That means proper fire insulation on support structures. It could mean concrete cores the height of the building. But there's still a big problem as Glenn sees it. There's a gaping hole in the code.
There's no, like, for example, if someone thought, oh, gee, there must be something in our building codes talking about how long it takes to evacuate. It's not in there.
The math part of figuring that out, by the way, is not that difficult.
A lot of the model is physics.
That's Lynn Hulse. She's part of an interdisciplinary fire safety engineering group at the University of Greenwich. A lot of modeling is just how smoke and fire move, relatively straightforward stuff.
Then you can look at in terms of the human behavior. That's the slightly more complex thing.
Lynn is a psychologist, so her part in this work is trying to figure out what people will do when a fire alarm goes off or when a plane smashes into the building next door. When trying to understand human behavior in these situations, she says strike one word from your vocabulary, panic.
It's very unhelpful. There's been a lot of studies discrediting it.
Lynn says the truth is people behave quite rationally, even in extreme situations. That was true on 9/11. Lynn was part of the team that interviewed hundreds of survivors. One thing that struck her is just how readily people listen to their bosses and managers, sometimes to their peril.
There were instances where people said they were told by authority figures that they couldn't leave because, you know, they were in the middle of a meeting and it was an important meeting and they stayed behind, unfortunately, for some of them to fatal result.
People also spent a lot of time just trying to figure out what was going on, going to the windows, asking their colleagues. All of this information seeking, as Lynn calls it, was time that could and should have been spent leaving the building. The problem, Lynn says, is with the nature of the alarms. An alarm going off only tells you that there's some kind of problem, but not much else about what's going on.
Often an alarm in itself isn't enough. The challenge then is to work at what kind of information to give, and not in the sense of, well, we can't tell them what's really happening because they might panic, quite the opposite. But it's just in sense of keeping it concise and also ensuring that it provides some information about where the threat is to give people the chance to make a decision about, okay, well, which exit perhaps should I take?
Lynn says, to her knowledge, no such system has actually been built. Like Glenn, the fire engineer, she sees the lessons of 9/11 only partly learned. For proof of that, Glenn says you don't have to go any farther than the site of the attacks themselves.
Even the 9/11 memorial itself, the museum, is 7 stories below grade. And so there's a big question of when you've got, you know, over 1,000 people in a museum, how do you quickly move those people out of a dangerous environment?
His team was never happy about it.
We didn't think it should be below ground in the first place. And we were very vocal about that. And we told them that. And, you know, they went ahead and did it anyway.
I went to check it out. The museum entrance is above ground, but that's about the only part.
Go down some escalators, past.
You barely notice you're going underground at first.
It's pretty wide, but crowded. Kind of corkscrews down.
It's dark. People keep pretty quiet, walking past preserved bits of wreckage, a destroyed fire engine, what used to be part of the tower's air conditioning.
It's a bit like the inside of a cave. No day shall erase you from the memory of time, Virgil.
It's etched in stone on a wall in this enormous hallway.
It's hard to tell how far underground I am now.
Finally, I come to the footprint of one of the towers. It's smaller than I thought it would be, this playground-sized square that used to be the building's borders.
Sorry, guys, is this the North Tower?
Yeah, this whole thing.
Is this the deepest part of the museum?
Yeah, this is the bottom.
Do you know how far down we are now?
About 7 stories, I would say?
7
feet.
The way back up, without stopping to look at displays, was tougher.
Here's some escalators. Don't know if these would be temporarily stairs in case of an emergency.
At some point, I noticed I was out of breath. I didn't realize it until I had to talk into the mic.
I don't know if it's the mask that's making me out of breath or if I need to start taking better care of myself. But we're almost out. Almost out.
And there it was. Finally, sunlight.
So how long would it take me to get out of here if I had to? I mean, full sprint? Take me 10 minutes? If everyone is going up at the same time? I don't know.
So yeah, I can see what Glenn was talking about. It's easy to imagine that memorial when you're way down there, becoming a tomb. I wanted to see an example of a building that works, though. One that was built with the lessons of the Twin Towers in mind, and I found it practically next door. Building 7 of the World Trade Center was destroyed by the collapse of the North Tower. Glenn tells me it was rebuilt about as resilient as can be. It checked off all of his many boxes. I went to check it out. Bill DeCanto is executive vice president in charge of operations at Silverstein Properties, the company behind the building. He shows me around, starting in the lobby.
This beautiful art wall is actually also a blast wall. And this wall will bend and shatter, but not shoot glass shards around. So anybody that's behind that would be protected as well.
So what makes it a blast wall?
It doesn't look like a blast wall, just your run-of-the-mill corporate facade, but look near the top and it's hung by cables instead of attached, meant to move with a blast rather than to buckle.
We have a fire command station here at the front desk, but we also have another fire command station in the building, but I'm not going to disclose the location of that.
Gotcha.
He can't show me all of their safety features, of course, security and all, but he can show me their pride and joy, the stairs.
This core is a 2.5 foot thick reinforced concrete wall. So the safety inside here is second to none.
The stairway is huge. I could imagine like 4 or 5 people walking down in a row. It's 20% wider than the wider post-9/11 code requirements. You can hear the echoes in Bill's voice.
So on both sides, there's 2 feet of concrete.
You are now within a concrete core.
Yeah.
Which is like a bunker.
There's space at each landing to put injured people or maneuver those with disabilities. There's redundancy after redundancy. A fiber optic cable just for responder communication. A cable for internal comms. Independent sprinkler systems.
The lighting system is on a generator and a battery backup, and we have photoluminescence.
The stairways here are perhaps unlike any anywhere else. If the building goes down, these stairs, I'm assured, will be the last part.
You couldn't take these down. Impossible.
The building has 2 main stairways that become 4, each that lead to different exits, with LED lighting systems directing traffic to the safest option, text displaying what's going on. Another lighting system is as simple as red means stop, green means go. You follow the lights through this corridor or that, down this staircase or another, until you're out. The thing that struck me about this system is just how much space it takes up, especially in New York City, land of the shoebox apartments costing fortunes.
It's interesting. It seems like there's stuff that's built that you don't use 99.99% of the time. It's just for in case the worst happens.
Yes, and you always need a plan B.